life has been good, and life has been full, and a lot of its fullness comes out of this very geography right here. My room happens to face out towards the notch up here. And I woke up to a typical late winter Holden morning, which is gray. And the sun started to come up finally. And I saw that beautiful notch up there that has some special place inside of me, because the first night that I was ever at Holden, the moon was right up there in the saddle, and it was full, and it was, that's a spectacular sight. Mm-hmm. But last fall, I was here for something, for a week or so, and it put on a special display up there. Moon was there, and Jupiter was there, side by side, and I happened to have a telescope along with me. So I spent until about 3 o'clock every morning out there, watching mostly Jupiter. That was the only thing putting on a show at the time. One night doing that, not last summer, but another time, I was standing there, and the people who had been dropping by during the course of the evening and up until about 1 o'clock had dwindled down to nothing, and I was still standing there looking through my telescope when I felt a nudge on the back, and I said, "Just a minute. I'm just getting something in focus, and I think you'll enjoy this." And then nudged again, and I said, "Hold it just a minute. I want to get this in focus, then you can look." Finally, I had it in focus, and I turned around, and it was a doe standing there. been feeding and wasn't afraid of me, and just happened to brush against me while I was standing there. So I talked to her for a little while, and she didn't get excited. She just kind of moved on gradually. Well, there's got to be some special place when creation gets that intimate, huh? You can't quite do that in a city where I suppose I spent most of my life. Now, sitting alongside of a river in Leavenworth, at absolutely the end of a lane, which has been named Ufta Lane, and if you want to know why, ask Elmer. He knows for sure now. It's the end of the lane, I suppose, kind of even symbolically, too. It's a place where we've decided that's where we'll live out our days. And it's a good place to do that. Wondrous community. Wonderfully supporting people. And close enough to Holden, so once in a while you get sneaking up here for that kind of renewal that is awfully good. Now, I haven't learned anything for 10 years, except in making sawdust. And I didn't just sawdust, but occasionally a bowl falls out that I can dare bring in the house. Usually not, but it's not very important. To me, the importance of the wood turning is to see the grain come out that I didn't know was there out of a piece of kindling wood that normally would go in my fireplace. Or to see passably respectable duck fall out of the sawdust, then that's fun. But the main thing is to make sawdust so that when Elmer gets stuck in our driveway late at night, I can throw sawdust under his wheels and get him out of there. All right, I don't know if this is what you want, and if we don't get at things that you might want, then let's start talking about something else. But it's a little hard for me to start talking about illness and health and healing and wholeness and all of those things without reminding myself and perhaps others that the roots of this wholeness, which come out of the creation itself. We were made, and we were made in a very specific and supposedly a very intentional way, and we are what we are supposed to be. I mean, we were made as we were supposed to be. We're not an accident. God looked at it, even at man when he was through. And by the way, don't get me hung up on inclusive language, would you? I believe in it with all my heart, but I can't use it. I'm too old to get my tongue re-educated. So if I use man, I'm going to use it in the sense of Adam, remember the name given, Adam, was the name that was given to him because of his mother, or given to it, or to person because of mother. Named Adam because he came out of the Adama, the stuff of the creation, out of the dirt, out of the ground, out of the earth. So he was named after the earth. So that's our name, all of us, regardless of gender, is really Adam. Let's remind ourselves a bit of it. There was some time, if there was a time in all of this creation, when God had a conversation with himself, and that mystery of the Trinity is kind of suggested in this. God said, let us make man in our image. At least I like to read into that. I don't know if exegetically that's sound or not. I don't particularly care. But it reminds us that God is, in some mysterious way, able to communicate with himself. Let us make man in our image. There's one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that says that God made us for his eternal company, which to me is a magnificent statement and reminds me that on this journey from wherever beginnings were and through temporary endings, that there is this continuity and the eternity of relationship with God. He made us for his eternal company. And let's have no doubt about it. Now, let us make man in our image. And goodness sakes, the theologians have fussed around with that one enough so that we can almost forget it, because no two books agree on what the Imago Dei really is. So I'm going to take a shot at it by, you know, because everybody else has, and they don't quite agree, and suggest that, at least for our purposes here, Imago Dei, or the image of God, could be stated as person, that we were made person as God is person, or three persons. And that it is this personhood of God and the personhood of man that makes all of this possible. We wouldn't be here if this were not the common denominator, which makes it possible to be in relationship with God. So he created us relational beings. But let's get at the dramatic stuff for a minute. The Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. I'm going to change that in a minute. But he made us out of the dust of the ground. I remember arguing with one of my colleagues at seminary one day about creation. He said, I just can't go along with anybody that even allows for the possibility of an evolutionary process, because we were created, and created means that we came out of nothing. So I open up the Bible that we happen to have on a table right beside us, and we were formed out of the dust of the ground, and this kind of rocked him for a bit, because he wasn't even going to allow for that in his kind of preformed thinking. Now, I happen to be believe in evolution, and I'm not going to quarrel with anybody who doesn't. The only thing I think that this says, and I think probably most of you agree with this, is that we come out of the hand of God. And what the process was is such a minor detail that we ought to get away from it instead of, unfortunately we have, we're not arguing that one much anymore. When I was a kid, and through college, this was a raging argument. You know. Now it's war and peace and a lot of other things. But this was the big raging argument. If I had been honest, I would never have graduated from Luther Seminary in 1939. Mm-hmm. Now, so new, I think, is some of the of the thinking. He formed us out of the dust of the ground. Now that's all. You can go any way on that one. You can go into a 7 or 6 day creational process, can't you? 24 hours a day, and say that God sculpted this, and that's perfectly acceptable to me. I don't care if you want to believe that. I don't happen to, but that's not the point of the whole thing. The point of it is that God in some way formed us out of the stuff of creation. Now, given that took billions of years, see, there's something kind of exciting about that also, isn't there? Great, majestic process. I'm not sure that I am able to swallow God as a magician who snaps his finger and there's light and snaps his finger and there's man and, you know, whatever. But now I'm arguing the point, am I not? But he formed us some way or another in this imagery and in this symbolic event. We were formed. We were defined. We were created by God according to his intent. And then he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. What that means, I don't know. That's, you know, kind of a CPR thing is possible. There's one, and I think I grew up thinking that, you know, with the image in my mind was of God kind of kneeling down and blowing into the nostrils of this foreign being. Okay. Or it could be something else that's meant here, that somehow or another God contributes to man something unique and different and special at that moment. And whether that moment is a moment of our, like our moments, or if it's a longer period of time, again, I wouldn't even argue that. But I think that there is a point at which man, human, person, is separated away from the rest of creation into a unique being. Now, the result of this, forming out of the dust of the ground and breathing into, the result of this is that man became. I tend to prefer to put a period at that point, because everything gets cluttered up as soon as you go into the rest of those words. The nefesh kaya is a complicated concept and term which had been described or has been interpreted and translated so many different ways. The King James Version, with all of its errors, used the word soul, that man became a soul in this event. But because we have cluttered up the word soul so badly and made it a fraction of what we are instead of the totality of what we are, later translators had to find some other word because it wasn't communicating very well. You know, the Greeks helped to distort this, I suppose, but Descartes put some good finishing touches on it, and we came up with neatly compartmentalized kinds of being in which soul was a fraction. But so very frequently in Scripture, the word soul refers to totality, not to a part, not to an aspect or a fraction. So I hope we can reinform the word soul, you know, and get that one used, because living being to me doesn't do it, does it to you? Living being, an ant is a human, a snake is a human being, an elephant, my dog, a lovely animal, is a living being.
Living creature, yeah,
same thing. What's
that? Living creature.
Living creature, yeah. To me, it's a meaningless expression and certainly doesn't do justice to the original words in this thing. Surely living creature is a part of what that nefesh. But there's so much more. There's a uniqueness to man. And I think that is what is suggested in this passage. Formed out of the dust of the ground. That part is so is the ant, so is the animal. But breathed into, and then man became whatever he is. Now, we might say that man wasn't given a soul. He became a soul. He wasn't given a body. He became a body. Depends on how you want to look at him, how you want to talk about him. We tend to see these as compartments and sections or divisions. Sections. It would be better if we looked at the human being as describable from several aspects, in several different ways. We are spiritual beings. We are spiritual. We are physical. We are emotional. We are relational. We are intellectual. We don't have mind as much as we are mind. We don't have soul as much as we are soul. We don't have body as much as we are body. As soon as we start to make these separable parts, we run into some very bad errors that science today is trying to correct. And isn't it too bad that somehow or another we let culture distort our theology to the point that we suckered in and bought this compartmentalized human being until, as science keeps on growing and you start looking into what happens when a person has a heart attack, you find out that there is you cannot explain that heart attack on the basis of some physical thing alone. Or you can't, all kinds of illnesses. We'll get into this more probably tomorrow. But the human being is whole, period. Now the parts may be distorted, the parts may be functioning not as well as they ought to be, but the human being is whole, or he's dead. You can't find any human who does not have a spiritual existence. You cannot find any human who doesn't have a physical existence. You can't find any human who doesn't have a relational existence, and so on, and an emotional existence. So we are whole. When we talk about toward wholeness, I think what we are talking about is how do we improve the qualities within each of these to bring them out to fullness. Probably get into that some more. Now, let me jump then to, I mentioned five sort of aspects or ways in which we can talk about the human being, the physical, the intellectual, the spiritual, the relational, the emotional, with the years that I have been confronted with illness in one form or another, and particularly in institutional settings. It has become quite interesting to see that when we went from a place, when I first started out, where there was a complete separation between, for instance, the work of the physician and the work of the pastor, or the work of the internist and the work of the psychiatrist, that these were neatly separated from each other. As though they were dealing with some different being entirely. And perhaps in these fantastic developments that we've had in the past, well, even 50 years, in curative medicine, just amazing. Just amazing. The advances in curative medicine. But serious questions about whether we're any healthier for it all. Very serious questions. People get cured of one thing and they come popping back in with something else. you can trace, and I've had a chance to see, and anybody who's been around hospitals for long periods of time and over many years has seen these thick chart patients that'll come in with something wrong here now today, a definite physical illness, huh? Not something imaginary or something that some people like to call, oh, that's just psychosomatic. Of course it's psychosomatic. How can it help be psychosomatic if the whole being is involved in every state of health or every day of illness? It has to be psychosomatic. It has to be a lot more than that also, but psychosomatic is really a meaningless term, I think. Because that suggests that there is a little category of illnesses, some of these ulcers, oh, that comes out of being worried. Huh? And you get too much juice flowing in and you start to just eating yourself up, you know. The old question, what's eating him or what's eating her? He is eating her or she is eating her. You know, by digesting away the linings of the stomach and sometimes putting a hole right straight through us. You know. But see, that was what some people wanted to choose out as a kind of an example of a narrow category of illnesses that were special. Now, as we dig deeper and deeper and deeper through many disciplines, down into this nature of man, we find that the lines of investigation converge on each other, and they say something about wholeness, huh, at that point. Molecular biology has been of enormous significance in our return to a concept of man that is consistent with Scripture. Now that's, I think, exciting. I wish I'd been born 20 years later so I could have gotten in on a whole lot more of what's happening in that area. To understand that crossover area between what we thought was purely physical and what we thought was spiritual or emotional or something else, to that crossover thing. Now, I can give you some of the gross anatomy of that sort of thing, and you probably all know it anyway better than I do, but let's just say that let's just say that I'm walking outside today with some minor arthritis and some flabby muscles and some overweight and a few things, which just multiplies what all of you have been experiencing this morning. It's a little slippery out there. And you have to keep your feet on your underneath and pretty firmly planted or you're going to end up on your butt. Now, let's just say that I start to slip and do a dance out there. I'm not a good dancer. I'm never very graceful, and certainly not under those circumstances. But all of a sudden, some wave of something goes from the top of my hair, and I mean that literally, your scalp tingles. There's a little itchy sensation up here, just in that flat, like that. It takes just, you know, these little millisecond things. And your muscles tone up, huh? Particularly if you're a fundamentalist. That's been demonstrated, you know, that people who are always preoccupied with the will of God, tend to walk with stiffer muscles, therefore they miss more steps and don't function quite as well as... Well, I had to learn that because I come out of the Haugus Synod, and you know what that is, that's Scandinavian Pietists. Huh? And I had to learn, and I learned it. That bone's been broken twice. This one's been broken once. No, I don't apply that to myself at all. But it has been shown that there's a significant difference between people who list their religious background as strict as over against those who characterize it in some other way as not at all or a relaxed and peace-giving kind of words that will describe that instead of rigidity and legalistic. So there's a significant difference in the number of broken bones between the two groups. All right, now human brain is up in here someplace, and up in here there's a cortex, a heart of labor layer that's kind of been added since the last age or something. We do a lot of our thinking with that frontal cortex, kind of a bark-like layer on the outside. So what happens when I get out on that ice now? Well, first, of course, I've got eyes out here someplace, down in here someplace, and I see some ice, and I see that my relationship to the ground is changing from a right angle perpendicular to a horizontal. And so I see that, and right away this funnels through here a little bit, but not for very long because there's no time for delay. Then it gets down into a little place right in here, the pituitary thalamus area. That's you take your thumb and you stick it in your mouth as far as you can go. Now, straight up, it's an inch and a half above that, that we're talking about. I remember once at Boston City Hospital, a doctor with whom I've become well acquainted said, "Fritz, stick around. I've got an autopsy coming up. I've got the brain. I want to show you something." So he starts digging things, and he got into the skull, got that out of the way, and here he had this brain. First time I'd ever seen one. He said, "Now I'm going to show you. You guys keep talking about this. I'm going to show you one." "What's that?" He digs out a little process about so big, and he said, "Now there is the soul. That's what you guys have been talking about." He digs out this little thing I'm talking about. Well, you know, not so far-fetched. I mean, there's some reason for his thinking this. Because out of this comes by some of these fantastic communications between the cells and the brain. There came some sort of stimulus to this. This one makes a judgment on it. Passes that judgment on to this one and says, "Do something about it." And that "do something about it" does something about it. I suppose a better analogy would be to say that I'm driving my car and I see somebody getting out of the lane, or I goof and start making the wrong turn or something, and I say, "Hey, this is dangerous. If I keep on this particular course, I'm going to hit that car up there and probably just get smashed all to pieces and end up dead." And then what happens? You know, I could, if I'm just going to reason this out, that's something like that. There's no time to think about this too much. That comes in a whole big intuitively formed body out of past experience and all kinds of natural things functioning. And it hits this pituitary thing that implements what I have to do now. There's a message that goes down right away to some digits that are down in here and the little gland that rides up from the top there. You'll see I'm an artist now. If you can. The adrenal glands. So some kind of a message comes down there and says, "Get pumping." And they squirt out some stuff, epinephrine or adrenaline, more commonly known. And then at the same time, a message goes down here to a diaphragm, that's down here, that's big here, and it's dome-shaped like this. And when you take a breath, you know, it keeps on going like this, huh? The lungs are inert. They don't have any power to suck in any air. What you do is create a vacuum there and the lungs fill up. And then you compress and the air is blown out. The message says, "Get moving faster. We need more air in this guy or this gal. More oxygen is the point." Now down in here you got an enormous thing. And some of it is much bigger than others. It's called the liver. This stuff here gets into, there's a heart up in here. And that heart is given a message, "Pump twice as fast, now." So all of a sudden, bang, 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 the heart starts going. If you ever get scared and your heart is pumping away fast, sing the doxology. If it doesn't happen, there's something badly wrong with you, terribly wrong. You need, if you're frightened, you need more gasoline. This is a supercharging event. That's what's happening.
What happens now, the blood is coursing much more rapidly. It picks up epinephrine or adrenaline, courses it through the liver, which is a storage bin for glucose and sugar, and it now puts into the bloodstream something called glycogen, which is a combination of sugar and oxygen, and that's the fuel that the body burns. Now, you're stronger. You think better because there's more supply of the brain too, huh? So you think faster in emergencies than you do in non-emergencies. You have more strength. Your muscles are being fed better, and they're fed on a supercharge with great hyped up blood. It's great stuff. Now let's just say that living in this modern world, I don't experience this kind of stuff too often, this kind of fright. I used to. I would have used to. My ancestors way back, many generations, used to, because somebody was coming at them with a spear. Huh? Or they might fall from the tail of a tree or something. But, there were different kinds of fright, and immediate action was called for. Today, we're in a different situation. There aren't so many times when our life is absolutely threatened, or we demonstrate the emergency, challenges. Instead of that, we've got other stuff going. It's a few days ago, it was the 1st of March, right? A few days before that, the ratio of junk mail to bills changed dramatically. More bills came in with the junk mail. And here I am with my checkbook and the bills, and I've got to pay that stuff now, the 1st of March. And it ain't working out quite right. Now that's just as frightening. Can be. My brain up here says, hey, buddy, you might get into serious trouble here. You've got to pay the bills, and there isn't enough money to do it. Now, this is a much more typical thing. Huh? We all, somewhere on other faces. But messages go down here, there's something wrong, get supercharged. So you could, I'm sure that it'd be easy enough to prove that around the 1st of the month, the average heartbeat of Americans is considerably higher than it was in the middle of February. Because as soon as you become anxious, your heart does tend to pick up a faster pulse rate. And that ain't good. Now, besides that, you've got some fantastically wondrous supercharged blood with this other stuff here. All dressed up and no place to go because you can't use it hitting somebody. And it doesn't quite fit with paying the bills. And I suspect, and I don't think anybody's ever even tried to measure this sort of thing, but I suspect that there's a toxicity that results from this that somebody's going to discover someday. And we're going to be dealing with that as one of the great dramatic improvements or understandings in the nature of man. It'll be if we could find out how to reduce that toxicity, well, I suppose maybe it wouldn't even be good with it, because what we would do then is take a pill to do it and not solve problems whatsoever. Life would remain as shallow as it was before, or shallower, or something. Like we've done with so much mental illness today, we've got pills for a lot of it. Drugs for a lot of it, that mask the problems that lie underneath. And so then people live lives that are something less than what they could be otherwise. Now, there are some other things that go into this, because this thing up here has got something going. It not only says, this is very dangerous, so heart get pumping faster, adrenaline gets shooting out into the blood. Get more oxygen into this blood. It not only says that, but for instance, it might say that Nothing can separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus my Lord. Now what does that do to adrenaline flow? Or to the tachycardia? It would be somewhat reasonable, certainly permissible, to think that it has considerable importance to it. But nobody has ever written a good text on the gospel for your stomach. No. How to calm down physiological processes that were built for one kind of situation and we haven't learned to adapt them. Or how about this tendency of the human being to get all shook up by change? Change probably kills more people than any other single factor. We are not very adaptable when it comes to change. This thing that I'm sure that you're acquainted with by this time, where you can add up. Forget the name of the guys now that made the scale. But for instance, they assigned some possible values to things like death of a loved one, divorce, loss of a job, things like that. And then as their studies went on, they found that getting married, getting a promotion into a new job that you've been dreaming of for a long time, the good things, good changes, were almost as significant as the bad changes. It's change that we couldn't adapt to, that were frightening in some way. And there's increased tension out of any of them. And these are harder to deal with than these other things. In the days when you could fall off and hit somebody hard with your fist, you could probably discharge a lot of this stuff. Last night we were talking about some of the psychology of the military mind or something of that nature, or of ourselves. The more war moves away from the immediate physical one-to-one, the more some of this other stuff rolls back in as dreadful repercussions. I saw this during World War II, the kinds of guys that I had to spend most of my time with were people who felt some of the anger and some of the guilt over all of this and some of the desperate frustration but had no way to do anything about it. Caught up. And then you find some people, and often with the most sensitive people, were disintegrating under all of this. Now let me give you some little examples here for a moment. A man came into our emergency room one night. We knew he was coming in because the paramedics had called in saying, we found this guy in the supermarket, flat out on the floor. And they, by the wondrous telemetry that we have today, sent in all the information and the data into the coronary care department of the hospital, and where it was immediately judged, and the doctors suggested what should be done for this guy lying on the floor of a jewel market in Chicago. So for a half hour, 45 minutes, he was treated there while lying on the floor. They didn't try to move him towards an ambulance, but they stabilized him. And when they saw that the heartbeat was straightening out a bit and that some other things were coming into line, and it was safe to move him, then they picked him up with some of this even fancy gadgetry that they have today, much better than the old stretcher stuff. And put him into this ambulance that had all kinds of stuff wired right into it, and were treating him the whole way into the hospital, and he got into the emergency room, and they took another look at him, and decided to put him up into the coronary care unit, where he received his life-saving help. He recovered from that heart attack. The progress for the first 2 or 3 weeks was just amazing. The guy became strong, heartbeat straightened out, probably better than it had been for years. And then, as it happened in so many times, we found that we had only cured, we hadn't healed at all. We had cured an episodic thing, the heart attack, which was trying to say something. Does the library here have Arnie Cirilla's Voice of Illness? Have you seen this book at all? Too bad. Cirilla. S-I-I, isn't it R-A-L-A? Do you know him?
No, I don't know.
Marty Cirilla is a, Marty, no, different word, Marty, is a psychoanalyst in Helsinki, and Arnie is a professor of theology at, what's the Lutheran Seminary in Toronto or someplace? You know?
Yeah.
You know which one I mean. They worked together quite a bit for a long time in a team. Two dedicated Christian men, and that's a little hard to come by when you think of a rather orthodox analyst who expresses his Christian faith as eloquently as Marty Cirilla does. And then his brother, who is the pastor and theologian. They worked together for a long time, and then finally they separated because Arnie came to teach in one of our seminaries here. But Arnie wrote a book called The Voice of Illness, in which he suggests that illness must be read. We must find out what its significance is. What is it saying to us? What does it reveal? He uses an interesting little analogy in the first place. He said, in Salem, Massachusetts, back in the 18th century, people were burned at the stake as witches. From our standpoint today, we look back and say, the society was sick, and the witch became the focal point of society's illness. And if you wanted to understand the illness of society, you look at the sick person and find out what in society created the illness. So you must listen to the voice of illness, says Arnie, quoting Marty. The two of them are almost inseparable. It's hard to know. Marty told me, I spent some time in Helsinki with him once. Marty said, Arnie was psychoanalyzed by Martin Luther. So when he saw my eyebrows go up, he said, Arnie did his deep Luther studies and came out of it with the equivalent of a magnificent psychoanalysis in depth through his Luther studies. Well, but if try to find that book, Voice of Illness. It's a, I wish I'd thought of it. I would have dragged one up here with, if I still have it. Well, anyway, to look at the illness and to ask questions that go beyond just what the immediate presentation of that illness is. In this case of this man lying on the floor in a supermarket, you know, it gets to be the heart attack. Okay, we patch that up and heal the heart. And if he needs a coronary bypass, we can easily take care of that. We might give him some warning about cholesterol and triglycerides and some of that sort of thing. You know, we might give him a little bit about that and take off some weight and watch the kinds of food you eat. Stay away from saturated fatty foods, saturated acids. Just be careful. And now we've got your heart in order. Well, in this particular guy, we were proud that we'd gotten them back into good health, but somehow or another the process that we were working hard so hard at Lutheran General at the time didn't get carried out with this man. And he was back in the hospital about 2 months later. But when he came in this time, he lived for about 2 days and died. And we couldn't do anything about him. We never really did get at anything with this gentleman, but there was another lady that had come in before, and we got started thinking about her, that here we had failed with a woman who died, who was picked up in somewhat the same way, but in her own home, brought in. We did the same thing, pulled out all the stops, got her heart going well, and she was feeling comfortable, and for all intents and purposes, a healthy person. And we let her go home, and she died that night. And we started to ask questions, how in the world can this be? Well, then we found out how it could be. We had goofed. We had cured a heart and not healed a person. If we had been healing a person and looking at a person instead of a heart, we would have found out that her daughter had made $12,000 that year selling drugs in the East, the main township high school parking lot. $12,000 that she had in a secret savings account in one of the banks in Des Plaines, Illinois. And the mother had discovered this when two detectives came to the door with a search warrant. She had been protected from the information. Her husband hadn't told her about this because he didn't want a row about it or whatever. They were trying to protect the daughter or whatever. At any rate, she had been picked up many times on drug charges, the daughter had. But through an influential father, she managed to keep getting out of, not being thrown into the detention homes, and was released, usually to her father. And the mother was never told anything about this because the mother got too excited about all this, any little disturbance that was brought up ever, so they didn't want to bring up a big disturbance. But when these two guys come and they've got search warrants to go up in her room, and she had to let them in, and they got up in the room and they found a whole big cache of drugs, not only marijuana, but a lot of cocaine, and this is a few years back now. And she was in a big operation. The girl was scared stiff because when those drugs were confiscated, because now whoever had given her the stuff to peddle, you know, was going to claim the worth of those drugs. So it was a dreadful situation for the little girl, but she was not our patient, or was she? Should she have been? How do you heal that heart? Because when the mother discovered this, within 2 hours, she was flat on the floor, out, in a serious heart attack. Why not? You've heard of broken hearts, haven't you? So then we go to work healing a heart, or curing a heart. Let me play with those words. Curing the heart, instead of healing the person and the family. Because how do you heal a person if we take what we were talking about earlier seriously here? We are relational beings. We stand on the one hand in relationship to God, and we stand on the other hand in relationship to our fellow human beings. And in varying degrees of intensity, we are in relational experience constantly. This relational experience was a key, in this case, to this woman's problem. When she came back into the hospital, she was dead on arrival. Because when she got home, she found out her daughter was in a detention unit and was sentenced for something like 2 or 3 years or something like that. And she just got home and found out that there was no change in the situation. And what she had kind of thought in the isolation of a hospital, you know, being withdrawn into this environment, getting better, no more chest pain. But, now this would mean, she thought, that life now was had been solved, the problem had been solved. She got home and found out that the mess was even worse than she'd imagined. She came out of the dream world of the hospital. And when that hit her, she died. We had not healed. It was only cured. We should have been working with a family, huh? How in the world can you treat an illness? Some of you had experienced some other countries. You know that one of the common things in primitive societies is a family will come, stand before the doctor, say, "Doctor, we are sick." Now the new doctor is apt to say, "All of you?" The experienced doctor says something like, "In which one does it hurt the most? Or in which one do you see it the clearest?" "Oh, it is in this one." So then the doctor does his Western medicine thing of looking for the part that is afflicted. But they are more right than he is, you see. We are sick. Anybody who's ever been faced with, I suppose all of you have, the dreadful thing of loved ones being sick, particularly critically ill, knows that we are sick. You better believe it. We are sick. Well, the trauma rooms in hospitals, emergency rooms, when people come in from accidents, quotes, accidents, I'd have to put that in quotation marks, because there aren't all that many accidents, unless you say that an accident is a predictable result of something, some activity. Drunken driving, of course, a big part of it. It's hardly an accident. If you walk outside this afternoon and an airplane happens to fly overhead and lose its engine and it comes down and clunks you on the head, I'm willing to grant that that's an accident. At least as far as you're concerned. But we better take more responsibility for the happenstances of life and see if we've set the stages for them. And to look behind things. I've had a heart attack. At the time that I was having it, I sure didn't even raise the question of who's responsible. You know. But in the time since that heart attack, I've had plenty of time to see, not only to ask that question of who is responsible, but to know how I was responsible for my heart attack. And the responsibility for my heart attack wasn't a lousy heart. That had nothing to do with it. I had a good heart. Responsibility for my heart attack went to a different problem of other unresolved things that did a couple of things. One of them was to speed up the heartbeat, make it a little bit irregular, so that plumbing part of the operation wasn't so good. Another one was I was building all kinds of goofy stuff that stuck to a spot about 3/8 of an inch long in one of my coronary arteries. Although I'd had cholesterol checks and they weren't in all that bad shape, but there was one specific spot where a lot of goof was clogging up the works. I had the excitement, by the way, of seeing into my heart on a screen right there. My heart. Here comes a probe that they stuck in down here, fed up through the femoral artery, and up, on up, and into the heart. I told the doctors, "You can do this crazy thing to me, which is kind of a risky business, but you can do it on one condition, and that is that you be sure that I'm awake when you get into the heart, because I want to see this." So I was kind of half dopey, because I keep you in pretty relaxed sort of condition while going through this. And then the doctor said, "Okay, you can wake up, buddy. You asked for it. what's that line from the TV show? You asked for it. There it is. We're right there, and that's the spot that caused your problem. But